welcome to BCFM's Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and in the studio this week is Labour MP for Bristol North West, Doug Naismith. Our old Labour political pundit and economics expert, Martin Summers, is here too. We'll be reviewing some of this week's news stories and talking to Doug about some of his work as an MP. We'll be following up also last week's story about St John's Conduit, a medieval water supply to Bristol city centre, which has stopped working for the first time in 700 years. And we'll also be finding out what you think about local and regional media here in Bristol with Marina Morris. But before all that, here's our two-week Friday Drive Time weather forecast from metcheck.com. This weekend, well, it's turning into jumper and jacket weather, isn't it? Average 15 degrees Celsius, and that's during the daytime. Cloud cover and rain to be cloudy but dry with some sunny spells. Thankfully dry. Next week, averaging a little bit higher, 17 Celsius, a fairly dry week, with Wednesday and Thursday and Friday looking most sunny. Next weekend, that's the 12th and 13th of September, temperatures averaging 17, so staying up and fairly dry with some sunny spells next weekend. That was the long-range weather forecast for the next fortnight from MetCheck.com. Well, on to our look through the week's news. And with us in the studio this week is Doug Naismith, who's the Labour MP for Bristol North West. Welcome to Drive Time, Doug.
Hello, Tony. How are you?
And what did you do before you became an MP?
Well, just before I answer that question, could I just say it's interesting that you described Martin as old Labour. I'm neither old Labour nor new Labour. I've been a member of the Labour Party for 53 years, and I've seen all different shades of opinions within the party, and I just call myself Labour. But what did I do before I became an MP? I'd done quite a few odd things, but the most recent occupation was I was a lecturer in the pathology department at Bristol University Medical School when I was elected to Parliament.
Okay, and are you a local person? You brought up around the Bristol area?
No, I was brought up in Scotland in a little mining fishing town called Musselburgh, just outside Edinburgh.
And so you found yourself working in Bristol, is that how you
came
to...
Well, I've lived in Bristol for 35 years. I moved here. I've been working in London and then gone to America and then come back to London, and I ended up doing a research fellowship in Bristol, and I've stayed.
What committees are you on, and what sort of things are you involved with up in London, in Westminster?
Well, I'm mainly interested in health matters, not surprisingly, given my background, and the Health Select Committee is my main focus of work. I'm one of the two longest-serving members of that committee, and I really devote most of my time to health-related policy and work with the Health Select Committee, but I'm also on another select committee called the Deregulation Committee, which is not the most popular of committees, but it does a lot of good work in getting rid of old-fashioned and outdated regulations and laws, and that's a little sideline of mine. But I'm also chair of the Backbench Parliamentary Scientific Group, which is the oldest backbench group in Parliament. It was founded in 1939, and that takes up a bit of my time as well, although it's not an official House of Commons committee, it's an official parliamentary backbench committee.
Because the deregulation is one of the things that we've been talking about over the last months here as one of the big problems that's led to the financial crisis. So is that something that you've been dealing with on that committee?
Only very recently, in that we've done a quick report just this year into what regulations need to be strengthened in the financial crisis. But there are other committees that deal with finance specifically, you know, the Treasury Select Committee and the Public Accounts Committee and so on. So we tend not to get so much involved with that. It's more regulations that hinder industry and that sort of thing, and commerce that we are involved with.
So do you think if that was more within your remit on your committee, you would have not allowed the industry to become so deregulated?
I am not sure that it was only deregulation that was the problem there. I mean, there certainly was greed and a sort of getting carried away with the idea that you could make a quick buck, and banking and finance traditionally has been based on the fact that if you could get capital in and then lend it out at reasonable rates, then everyone could be happy. The people who needed capital and investment funds would get it, and people who were investing for savings would get a return on the savings, which would be useful. Now that is something that I'm very interested in, because I'm also a cooperative MP, Labour Co-op MP, and mutualism and cooperation is something that's very important to me. And that was the way the old mutual building societies used to work until some of them got a bit too modern and a bit carried away. But there are still some very traditional and successful ones about.
So do you agree then that it is deregulation that's at the heart of the problem with all these derivative markets and really allowing the city to regulate itself?
I think that there's a strong element of that, and we need stronger regulation. I mean, the Chancellor has said that, that we need stronger regulation, and I agree with him.
Okay, and also, it's very interesting that you're on the Health Select Committee, because we're one of the big things, along with the economic crisis that we've been discussing over the past few weeks, is the swine flu pandemic. Have you been dealing with that quite a lot at the Health Select Committee?
No, I mean, what the Health Select Committee does, the Health Select Committee carries out investigations into things that, you know, we consider are important, and we're in the middle of a couple of them, as well as we call ministers before us and ask them about things, but we haven't called a minister before us yet.
So what are your own views on it then, as a doctor?
I used to be an immunologist. I'm not a medically qualified, I was a scientist,
okay.
An immunologist, which means being involved with antibodies and T cells and things like that, things that regulate infections and transplant rejection and all that sort of thing. And allergies, and that's what I'm really specialised in. And the immune responses to viruses is one of the things that I used to do a bit of work on.
So will you be taking the will you be taking this vaccine then, and the Tamiflu? Because it does seem that there are some quite serious health considerations over that.
Well,
and
these are being grossly exaggerated. Any new vaccine needs to be tested, but this isn't strictly speaking a totally new vaccine, because some of the antigens will be old antigens that have been incorporated before. And I may well take the vaccine if it's considered, but actually, I think there's been a great hype about this swine flu. It's not terribly lethal. It doesn't cause really serious illness in the vast majority of people who get it. Young people who may not have any immunity, and if they're exposed to it, then they may have a little bit. I mean, children, babies may have a little bit more of a reaction. And people who are weak for other reasons, because they're suffering from some immunodepression, there are all sorts of ways that can happen. They're particularly vulnerable. But what this swine flu is, it's quite infectious, so it's spread rapidly. And that's why it's called a pandemic. People think, oh, a pandemic must be serious. Actually, all it means is that it's spread rapidly, and usually it's something that's very serious. But in this case, I think it's been hyped up a bit.
Okay, well, you're not on your own with me here in the studio. Martin Summers is here too, our old Labour economics expert and pundit.
I'm not strictly sure what old Labour means, but Martin will probably tell us.
Well, that's Tony's description of me. I'm just a member of the Labour Party, as you are, Doug, and I've been a member since 1975, and that's all it means, really.
So anyway, Martin, why have you stayed a member of the Labour Party when so many in the anti-war movement have left?
Because I think that it's we were out canvassing during the local elections recently here, and that's an important discipline for those who want to change society. It's all very well talking to yourselves in small groups and generating new ideas of things you'd like to do, but the real test of that is, can you convince ordinary people that you are going in the right direction? I mean, it wasn't easy, I can tell you, with the government in the straits that it's in at the moment. But I think that if people think that the collapse of the Labour movement and the Labour Party is something to be welcomed, then I think they are fools, because it's a major protection, especially for the most vulnerable in society. A lot of the pensioners, for example, we were talking to on the doorsteps, continue to be loyal to the Labour Party because they understand that their healthcare and very much depends upon the National Health Service being protected and supported.
And what are your views then on what Doug was saying just now about deregulation and whether that's really to blame for the economic crisis that we're in at the moment?
Well, I suppose this is where the old Labour...
I've got
a degree in economics, and I've never believed in free market economics. It just doesn't make... The two key events in the last few years which have led to this economic crisis are the Big Bang in the city in the 1980s and the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act in the United States during the Clinton era. The Glass-Steagall Act used to separate mutuals and banks which were doing what Doug was saying earlier from the investment banks, which are the casino banks. And that Glass-Steagall Act was brought in the 30s precisely because of the crash of 1929, when the casino end of the financial system had infected the more stable end. And, you know, a lot of those rules and regulations were put in place in the 30s for a good reason, to prevent bubbles, crashes and slumps. And the economics textbook has been rewritten over the last 30 years, and now we're coming back to we're coming full circle to suddenly realising that in actual fact we need regulation, we need government intervention, and that's the only way to manage the economy.
I don't disagree with that at all. I think we do need regulation, and there were regulations which were in force, which were on the statute books, which weren't enforced, which would have made a lot of difference to the outcome. But I would take up one thing with what Martin says, and he and I probably share quite a lot in our backgrounds. The idea of the subject of I've just forgotten what it was I was going to say. What was he just
talking about? We're talking about Glass-Steagall Act.
Glass-Steagall Act's a bit too esoteric for me, but you know, I know what you mean.
But
what I was going to say was, you said you didn't believe that free economics would work, or you were no interest in it really, and it had to be changed. I'm not against that, as long as we've got some regulation. But I also, I used to be, once upon a time, Secretary General of the European Federation of Immunology Societies, and I travelled quite widely. This was in the 80s, late 70s, early 80s, in Eastern Europe. But I can assure you that these societies were absolutely abysmal for the people who lived there. The science, which was what I was interested in then, was virtually non-existent, and people were not allowed to think. They didn't have any of the consumer goods, and of course probably it's gone too far the other way now. But these societies were not societies where there was no market at all, no free trade, were completely awful places to live.
Well, I mean, I actually agree with that. I mean, I used to work in Eastern Europe as an economic advisor for the New Economics Foundation. And, of course, my vision of a managed market economy is not the same as the Soviet system. Yeah. But I wrote a book with Dr. Laszlo Andor of Budapest University of Economic Sciences critiquing the free market policies that have been pursued subsequent to the fall of the Berlin Wall.
Yeah.
There was a lot of ideology and not a lot of analysis. If you're starting with a rigid communist system, it's a very if you just smash it to bits in one frenzy, you run the risk of plunging the whole population into poverty and misery. It needed to be dismantled in a stable way, and that implied, if you like, government intervention, but of a more intelligent sort.
Yeah.
And that's what was lacking. The ideology was, we don't need to have a plan. The market will. But they used to tell a joke in Poland. How many Poles does it take to change a light bulb under communism? 5. 1 to change the light bulb, and 4 to move the chair he's standing on. And under communism, you don't need any poles at all, because the market will do it.
Like so many things, it's just a question of balance, isn't it?
You
go too much one way, too much free market, you end up with trouble, unregulated free market. Too much the other way, rigid state determination of everything, you end up with trouble. So what we need is something in the middle.
Okay, well anyway, let's go in to have a look at some of this week's news stories. And I have to say, it's been something like 3 or 4 weeks now that Lockerbie has been in the news, and we did look at it when it was first appeared, so we're having a revisiting it this week. We've got various stories to look at. One that caught my eye was the revelation in the Daily Mail that Dawn Primorolo, who's also a Bristol MP, has been over to Libya. Now, she's a health minister, but I mean, she's also in her time had the finance portfolio, hasn't she? So I wonder if this is possibly related to all these rumours that there are about a deal with the Libyans over finance.
Well, I haven't seen Dawn for about more than a week, but when I do see her, I'll ask her what she was doing.
Yeah, apparently she conducted talks with the senior figures in Tripoli last November, according to the Mail, back on the 27th of August.
Well, she was a health minister then, so I don't know what the answer will be, but as you say, she was also involved in the Treasury for a long time. And it is not unreasonable that we should have ministers who are interested in what's happening in Libya.
No, of course not.
Because it's very important.
Doug, what's your thoughts about this whole Lockerbie business?
Well, my basic thoughts are, I think it's been extremely badly handled, and I personally would not have been prepared simply just to release Al Megrahi, even though being Scottish, I'm well aware of the Scottish legal system and the fact that it is more tolerant and more friendly in many ways than other places. But the thing is, maybe a prisoner exchange would have been more sensible. But in terms of whether Megrahi was responsible for the bombing or not, it's very hard to be sure. He probably played some minor part in it, but he certainly wasn't the only one. And that's what makes this so difficult to get one's head around.
Well, isn't that...
If you're sure he was guilty, then you could be much firmer in your views.
Isn't that the crux of the matter? Because we have an article in yesterday's Glasgow Herald, too much heat and not enough light on Lockerbie. So what they're saying really is that there's been loads of fuss about this whole business, but not really very little light shed on the actual guilt or otherwise of Al Megrahi. Martin?
Well, I mean, to my mind, the most worrying thing about this is Megrahi's appeal was dropped. And from all of the indications are, from reading Scottish legal journals and so on, is that he was going to actually succeed in that appeal. And we've also got from the Scotsman of 2008 here that Megrahi's defence team had contacted a senior Scottish police officer who was prepared, he's not been named, but he said he was prepared to testify at the appeal that the timing device which linked Megrahi to the bombing was planted and that he had been involved in planting that device. Now, if the appeal had succeeded, presumably Megrahi would have been not proven that Megrahi was involved. But then the question comes up: well, who did do it, and what sort of and all this all of these attempts to frame Megrahi look as if they were part of a shift in geopolitical orientation by the West. Originally, the Syrians were blamed as a result, supposedly in revenge for the shooting down of the Iranian Airbus by the USS Vincennes. And that was the official story. But then in the 1991s, as the first Gulf War was getting going, the Syrians were our allies, our glorious allies, and so we could hardly go around accusing them of blowing up airliners, so that the whole focus of the investigation then shifted to Libya. But I think what's happened here is two things. The Scottish legal system has been shown to be manipulable. This court in Zeist, which convicted him, doesn't seem to be a regular court.
Well, it had no jury,
there's
for
no
example.
No jury, etc. But of course, eventually the appeal process does work, because we still do have a functioning legal system. And if the appeals had gone through, I think if the appeal had gone through, he would have been let go. And then the question comes, who really did it, and why has the government been covering it up all these years? And just a final point, if the government is lying about something as important as this, the deaths of nearly 300 people on an aeroplane, what else are they lying about in this fabulous war on terror that we keep being told about?
There was another thing I noticed in one of these articles, and it was saying that there were a whole load of sewing machine needles apparently found all over the site near Lockerbie, and there is some doubt as to whether what they were doing on there, and whether they were actually something called a flechette, which is some sort of weapon which was possibly being illegally carried on the plane too.
Well, this is all from the article in The Firm, which is the Scottish legal journal. But I mean, it's very difficult by not having the appeal in front. We've not been able to deal with all of these questions. They will carry on being questions into the future now. And Dr. Jim Swire, who's the leader of the spokesperson for the British victims, has always believed Megrahi was innocent, and he helped Alan Frankovich to make the film which was shown on Channel 4, the Maltese Double Cross. Which covers most of the territory which we're wading into here, but it's very difficult to examine all of the evidence. I mean, that's what courts are for, is they're supposed to examine the evidence.
Well, I think it may well be that Al Megrahi wasn't guilty, certainly didn't do it all on his own, but I'm not, never have been a great friend of conspiracy theories. I mean, people will give you three or four different ways that Kennedy was assassinated and every other major problem. There are hundreds of different theories and people speculate, particularly if there are governments involved. There's a lot of speculation involved in all of this. People like to have plots and so on, and you know, there are people who have seen spaceships landing and it's supposed to have been covered up by the Americans. It's just something that, as a scientist, I like to see solid evidence. Now, I agree we may have been denied the evidence, but it's the least likely of the things that are the reasons for all this. I think it would be difficult to have denied Al Megrahi the chance to go home if he is going to die in 3 months. And the rule said that if he got to go home, then they would have to deny the appeal. He'd have to withdraw his appeal. I don't know how true
I don't think he didn't have to withdraw the appeal.
Well,
some people,
it seems that
a deal has been done, which he has withdrawn the appeal. But in fact, he could have continued the appeal, in theory. I mean, but he
could have continued the appeal even if after death.
Yeah, well, yes. Yeah. I mean, okay. The appeal. The appeal could carry on.
Who would pay for that?
Well, I presume he's withdrawn. He's withdrawn voluntarily.
There's some doubt about just how voluntary.
Well, I agree.
Voluntarily or not.
The British government says he withdrew voluntarily. I have my suspicions, as probably you do, that perhaps there was some pressure behind the scenes. But
No, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about under the Scottish legal system, he had to withdraw his appeal to arrange for a...
Oh, to be released, yes. Oh, I see. Yeah.
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
What are your thoughts then, Doug? Does it not help then to be poring over who actually did it? And it's Jim Swire, you see, who's the representative of the victims and the families, has been the one person who's been saying that the legal process hasn't been correct.
What I'm saying is I don't believe we've got the truth about what happened with the Lockerbie incident, just simply in charging and convicting Al Megrahi. There's much more to it than that, I'm sure. But whether we'll ever be able to find it out or not, I don't know.
Finally, then, on Lockerbie, we've also heard that the BP have been lobbying Jack Straw before he changed his mind over the Lockerbie bomber. So do you think that it's possible that there's some sort of, Martin, that there's some sort of oil deal with the Libyans is also involved in this massive deal that was possibly done by Peter Mandelson in Corfu?
It wouldn't surprise me at all that, you know, BP were lobbying... you know, Jack Straw, if he thought it would benefit, you know, the trade. But, I mean, I don't know that there's any evidence that there's a direct link, and this is the sort of thing that large firms do all the time.
Well, obviously, Doug is right. This is the sort of thing that large firms do all the time, and it's likely that because of all the fuss that was going to happen about this, that people will have tried to negotiate at arm's length so that they can't link the two things together. I still think we must look at incidents like this. I'm picking up on what Doug was saying about conspiracy theories. Of course, there's plenty of speculative theories floating around out there, but we do know in historical there is a historical record of skullduggery of various kinds being carried out, for example, by the CIA. We know about the Iran-Contra affair. The Lockerbie incident happened right in the middle of when Iran-Contra was functioning. Somebody like Colonel Oliver North in the United States is a hero in the United States, but Senator Kerry's committee uncovered that he was involved in terrorism, drug dealing and murder, all of which are capital offences under US law, and he and many others involved in the Iran-Contra were all pardoned by George Bush Sr. As when a president resigns or leaves office, they can pardon up to 200 people.
Yeah.
Extraordinary. And all of these people were pardoned. And all of those people not only did not go to prison, they came back to power under Bush the Younger.
Can you just remind us in a nutshell what the Iran-Contra affair actually involved, Martin?
Well, the Iran-Contra affair is thought of as arms for hostages in the US, but of course what's really going on is the support of the Contra rebels in Nicaragua, who carried out a vicious terrorist campaign against the democratically elected government of Nicaragua, and they were funded by massive cocaine shipments into the United States. And this was all uncovered by Senator Kerry's committee. So a lot of the drug problem, and Mike Rupert, who is LA anti-narcotics chief, has also written a book about this called Crossing the Rubicon. And this again is not like conspiracy theory, like we think they're covering up UFOs or whatever. This was all uncovered by US investigations. But the fact is that people just put it back, just said, all right, well, that's never mind, we've done all of that, but let's move on. Now, how can we move on? The problem is that the United States has got a very strong criminal element embedded in its state apparatus, and it's still there now under Obama. We've got to deal with this. Similar as it's got to be dealt with in Russia, it's got to be dealt with in the US, it's got to be dealt with in all these African countries. The state apparatus needs to be held to account by politicians and others, and the society at large.
I don't disagree with what Martin's saying. He is saying something that is irrefutably true, that the Americans particularly, but sometimes with our assistance, they tend to favour and support right-wing governments around the world, and that's something that I agree with Martin about. It's got to stop.
Okay, this week's other news stories in a minute. That's all about Lockerbie. But first, Marina Morris has been out and about on the streets of Bristol canvassing your views on the local press, and she will also look at whether the local press is likely to be able to survive the internet age. Hi, Marina.
Hello. This week I have been looking at various statistics about the British media. The United Kingdom has a long tradition of a free and often outspoken press. According to a governmental statistic, Britain in 2000, over 85% of people read a regional or local newspaper. The latest published comparable statistic, UK 2005, the official yearbook quotes nearly 27% read a regional daily paper, and nearly 28% of adults read a paid for local weekly title. Whilst there may be some unreliability about overlaps in the statistic, it is clear that there has been a major decline in the popularity of local newspapers. According to the same sources, in 1980, well over half of people aged 15 and over in the UK read a national morning newspaper. 61% of men and 52% of women in 1997-98. And in 2005, on an average weekday, just over 50% of adults in the UK read a national newspaper. The popularity of national newspaper appears to be falling, but not as drastically as for the local press. But what has happened since 2005? There are many more recent published statistics giving often apparently contradictory messages. Perhaps the best guide to changes in the popularity of newspaper is what we see with our own eyes, the growth of the internet. Most newspapers produce an online version, the competition from the television and radio, the emergence of 24-hour news channels. The Press Complaints Commission deals with complaints about the content and conduct of newspapers and magazines and operates a code of practice agreed by editors, which covers inaccuracy, invasion of privacy, harassment and misrepresentation by the press. In 2003, the Press Complaints Commission received 3,649 complaints, a 39% increase on the previous year. Most complaints breaching of the code, 96% in 2003, are resolved by editors. This week I have been out onto the street of Bristol to find out what you think about the local media.
Where do you get your local news?
I get my local news from the BBC, more so from the website. There's quite good coverage. I suppose I don't watch local news as often as I'd like. It's more so the national news, but still, BBC would pretty much cover it all for me. I don't know, it's just the image I have of ITV is not that great. It's more so from the late night call-in shows for the win money. I think it's still stuck with me, but other than that, it's the BBC has a more professional image, I think.
Well, the local news I sort of get from Points West or ITV West. It's very informative, although I think they've changed the format a bit and it sort of covers more of the southwest than just the immediate sort of Bristol area. It's just that it keeps you up to date for events and everything that are happening and news for around the Bristol area, really.
Get the local news from the Evening Post and BBC and ITV news broadcasts. Mainly because if I miss getting the Evening Post, then it brings me up to date on some of the facts. Not always true, but some of them anyway.
I get my news mainly from the TV news or from the internet, and it's quite good. I've been around the country recently, and I think it's slightly better than some of the other regions. So it's mainly television and the local radio as well in the morning, BBC News. I think it's a bit more accurate, a bit more detailed, a bit less sensational, you know, than ITV. More accurate. I think that it's detail, you know, that there's enough detail, and that it's well clearly presented.
There's not much, I'd say. I normally get Metro on the bus and just go through it, and I can't think of one actually that will excite me. I don't know. No, I read Guardian as my main paper, so I can't. Yeah, it just gives you broad information. You know, you'll get more news from that. You know, I don't think there's a very good local one. Maybe I haven't heard of one yet. So, yeah, maybe you can recommend me one.
I read my parents' Evening Post if I feel like it. I might watch news, possibly.
I read the Daily Mail, sometimes news, the internet.
MSN stuff. Yeah, MSN news mostly. I don't really use a lot of local stuff. And the metro, because I got the bus a lot.
What do you expect from the media?
What I expect from the media, I think it would just be overall, if it's still the news and, like I say, the accuracy in entertainment, but the media overall is just fair reporting, not spin stuff too much, because, like I say, it gets to a cynic and actually ruin people's lives and that, but I think that's pretty much it. The accuracy of the news, be objective, because I know that some media companies like to spin all the news, and that gives kind of false image to everyone. So it's just be truthful, report on what we would want to know, in the sense of I'm not really into as much of the entertainment side. I just want to know sort of what's happening that would actually affect us direct, such as, you know, taxes, that sort of thing, or any big stories.
Informative news, up to date, and the truth, really. Possibly the weather, local events, and then just general sort of news as to what's been happening within the Bristol area.
I expect the truth, and sort of general broadcast of it with no distortion.
I expect to be kept informed and up to date, and possibly entertained on occasions.
Easy going, nothing too serious. To be informed and to be entertained.
The media, I don't know, just make it more exciting. Make it easy to read and, you know, for younger people. And
how can the media's communication be improved?
I think through different formats. I think a lot of them do it on the internet, so that's quite good, because that's my preferential one. I think the radio is quite good. But they could advertise it more. It's just on the go, you can listen into it. And other than that, it's with the TV, I think it's fine, to be honest.
Perhaps not to be so intrusive with various events or happenings where, you know, people are upset or things like that. I think they are a little more intrusive on that sort of thing. And also sort of on the celebrity side of things.
To broadcast their both points of view. If there's a yes or no aspect to it.
No good repeating national news. Something happens in Bristol and it's national, fine. But if something happens in Bristol and it's local, that's what you do. Don't keep repeating.
I think some of it needs to be a bit less opinionated, like more neutral. Not more biased, more unbiased.
Well, that's Marina Morris's Vox Pop out on the streets of Bristol. Doug Naismith, who's Labour MP for Bristol North West. Doug, what do you think about the local press here? When you're doing an initiative up in Westminster, do you find that you get reasonable coverage of it down in Bristol?
Yeah, reasonable coverage if it's interesting, intrinsically interesting, and that ought to mean something that's locally interesting and of interest to people in Bristol, which is, as someone said there, they don't really want rehashed national news put out in the Evening Post, unless, didn't actually say so, but I would add, unless it has a particular Bristol connotation to it. People get very upset about changes in the news. I remember when I first started in Bristol, which is over 30 years ago, taking a real interest, because I was either standing for the council or standing for the European Parliament, which I did once. And in those days, if I used to go into Radio Bristol and get interviewed with Roger Bennett, who was the star of Every Day in Bristol once upon a time, he told me that they got the news from the Western Daily Press, and anything that was in the Western Daily Press that morning, their reporters went out and followed up, and that was where that ran most of the media around here. We're still lucky that we've got the Evening Post, Bristol Evening Post, and the Western Daily Press, but they're both of them very different now from what they were 20 and 30 years ago.
So what changes have you seen then?
Well, they tend to be, for instance, they used to report speeches in the council house, you know, councillors made, just like the Times used to report verbatim what was said in the chamber of the House of Commons. Neither of those things happen now. Probably a good thing, because people want much more sound bites and entertainment than facts. Someone said in your Vox Pop that what they wanted was entertainment, information, but truthfully, and I think these three things sum it up. And I think probably media nowadays are less of all these three than they used to be.
Well, how much has that, do you think, got to do with the change of ownership of the Evening Post and Western Daily Press? Because it was originally set up in the 1930s as a Bristol-based, pretty much a family business. And slowly but surely, I think mostly during the 80s and 90s, it was then taken over by Northcliffe, which is a part of the Daily Mail group from London, which the original Evening Post was actually set up to compete against. So, I mean, what extent do you think the what the Evening Post covers, and for example, the lack of coverage of the City Council, is to do with the change of ownership? And what do you, and to what extent do you think it's just a change of style?
I think it's a change of style. I mean, clearly it was set up to oppose, you know, the then press barons and people, local people wanted control of their own newspaper. But in recent years it's been in competition, you know, I'm talking about 2030, it's been in competition with the people, you know, that we're talking about. And they've had to change the style, which then makes it much more difficult to differentiate it from the people they're competing with. So it ends up, whether they're efficient at the job or not. And at the moment, all newspapers are finding it quite hard to finance what they're doing, because advertising is dropping and transferring to other media, and on these other media, sometimes also owned by the newspapers, it's very difficult to get money in. A lot of it's free, and so there's a real crisis in the newspaper industry and news industry at the moment.
What about local BBC and ITV, used to be HTV, now ITV
West?
They're
cutting back on their local regional coverage quite heavily, both of them. And that's because of costs, as they say, and probably it's very expensive now to maintain different units in Bristol, in Bath, in Plymouth, and all over the southwest. And so it's become regionalised and even more concentrated than it was just a few years ago.
Well, one of the things that I've noticed is that much more of the material you find in the, particularly in the papers in Bristol, is press releases, whereas in the old days it was more, you know, if you look through papers from sort of 10, 15 years ago, you'll find there's more which has either been phoned into the newspaper, stories which have been phoned in by the public, and also where the paper itself and journalists have actually proactively been going out and grabbing stories.
There are fewer journalists than there used to be, because really good journalists are expensive. And you mentioned the Glasgow Herald earlier. Well, my son used to be deputy editor of the Glasgow Herald until a couple of years ago, when they were taken over by an American firm, and they've gradually pared off, and they've now merged three newspapers into one with one editorial team. So he's still a senior journalist there, but he's not deputy editor anymore. But he's still got his job. Same thing's happened with the Bristol Evening Post and the Western Daily Press. They've now got one team of journalists doing the job, and if there's only one journalist for a story, then you only get one version of that story. In the old days, you could have compared what the Western Daily Press said with the Evening Post and maybe got a different perspective.
Martin, what about you? Do you read any of the local newspapers or watch local television, listen to local radio news?
The Evening Post is probably the main route by which I get local news, and of course your own programme, Tony. I think it is a very important thing to have a local press. It's very important for community and for a sense of community, and for all the reasons that Doug has explained, because of the changes in technology and the way the market is working, we could end up with a situation where there is no real proper local press scrutinising local decision making and local problems, and that will make us the poorer.
It's a bit concerning.
Some other way to communicate if we haven't got these old mechanisms.
Well, it's a bit concerning what Doug was saying about the lack of coverage of the City Council, some of the debates and that sort of thing. It seems that we're now not seeing what's going on inside the council chamber so much.
It's interesting that the City Council has put itself online so that people can watch City Council meetings taking place from outside the chamber. Sorry, Martin, you were supposed to...
No, that's fine. I mean, I
but do you think people really do that? Do you go online to watch the City Council? Really, what you want is the journalists...
I'm a political, you know, junkie.
Yeah, but what you want is the journalists to be scanning through all this stuff and to say, well, actually, here's something really important. Yeah. I mean, in the general public haven't got the time to be doing that, have they?
They will put decisions of the council on the front page if they are controversial, when there have been quite a few recently.
Yeah, I mean, obviously there's a limit to how much people are going to be interested in the minutiae of council business. Unless, of course, it's a decision which directly affects them, like the closing of an old people's home or whatever.
Yeah, we were talking about that a few weeks ago, yeah.
And want to know. I think you've got to get the balance right. I mean, you can't force feed people, you know, things that they're not very interested in. But I mean, you know, most people I think are interested in local affairs. I mean, for example, look at the success of GWR. Yeah. If you go around the city, people have all got GWR, which is a local radio station because it's got music on. But what people like is A, the traffic news, and B, the local gossip. And I think that in the US, all radio is local mainly. They don't have like national radio.
Okay, we haven't really talked much about the television because ITV nationally is suffering a cash crisis at the moment. Do you think it matters if we only have one regional bulletin by the BBC? And what value do you think ITV West are doing with their bulletin?
As I was saying about, you know, the Evening Post and the Western Daily Press, you can sometimes get two different views, different takes on the same piece of news. If you only got one bulletin, then it diminishes the chances of arriving at this illusionary and very difficult to find truth.
Okay, now let's have a look at some of the other stories from the week. We're starting off with Ed M. Rothschild is pitching, apparently, a motorway privatisation plan. I think that one was from the Times yesterday. Motorway privatisation plan. I think the idea is that this is going to help to raise finance for the government, who are strapped for cash. Martin, do you want to start on this one?
Well, I mean, it looks like a version of road pricing, and in the past, this has been a terribly unpopular idea. I mean, road pricing might, in theory, be a good idea, but there's an awful lot of consumer resistance to it. When people get used to consuming something for free, i.e. the road, it's very hard to challenge to ask them to pay for it. I mean, that seems to be what's implied here. And I can't see that the Jeremy Clarksons out there are going to like this at all.
Well, apparently, the Liberal Democrats deputy leader and Treasury spokesman Vince Cable has said this is an attractive, positive idea which could release considerable resources to the public finances and may have real environmental merits. What about it? Do you think it's going to be a good idea?
I agree with what Martin said, that, you know, road pricing and sort of charging for motorways and toll roads is very unpopular with the public, but this great city of ours is choking to death under motor vehicles. You can sometimes, particularly if the schools are in, which they're not at the moment, it's been quite pleasant driving around, but even tonight there was quite a jam getting here for me, and people complain all the time that cars are parking on pavements which are supposed to be illegal. Nobody expects, only a few people expect the police to do anything about it nowadays, because it would mean whole streets people couldn't park and they'd have to find somewhere.
But isn't this
we need to find some way of reducing the use of air. And with my old Labour hat on at the moment, yeah, a good strong regulation to do that would help. And maybe if we operated like they do in Scandinavia, where they have high taxes, much higher than ours, and I often think they have a much more civilised society. They don't have nearly this trouble, and they raise money for public transport and for other things as well.
But isn't that one of the reasons why so many families now have a car or two cars or even three cars, is because the public transport is so expensive and unreliable?
Well, but it's a very chicken and egg argument. If you've got the roads choked and buses can't get along them, even with one bus lane on one side of the road, people are not going to use buses if they're not fast. And that's the biggest complaint about buses in Bristol. They sometimes turn up, they sometimes don't turn up. Sometimes if they turn up, they take ages to get where you're going. And where do you start with this argument?
What worries me is, because of the economic crisis, we're approaching all of these problems as how can we raise money to save off, you know, further disaster, as it were. The economic crisis rightly ought to be seen, in my view, as an opportunity to get things right. Yeah. We're going to need a massive boost of public investment in things like mass transit into cities, like a tram system perhaps for Bristol or something like that. Now, this is a much better use of public resources than buying up junk from the banks. And the problem is that we've spent what's happened very, very rapidly over the last 2 years is that we've pledged the tax take for the next two generations simply to bail out the existing financial structure. Now, if you're going to reflate the economy through public spending, which now seems to be a consensus that that's the sort of thing we ought to do, then we ought to buy something which is actually worth something in the long run. An investment in public transport infrastructure is staring us in the face as an obvious thing to invest in. But of course the problem is that we're now getting a situation where we could have a Conservative government saying, oh, we've got to cut back on everything because we've got no money. This could easily plunge the economy into a deflationary spiral, but B, it'll put off forever dealing with these problems in a constructive overall fashion.
Do you think we're going to see a toll booth at the start of the M32 if Vince Cable and Rothschild get their way?
It might be a good idea, and I probably agree with Doug that we ought to have more regulation of these of the private car, as it were. But you can understand how difficult it is, because the public get, you know, once you're path dependent, and if your family has got three jobs in three different areas and you've got three cars to go to those three jobs, you can't really easily change that. And we should have done all of this years ago.
I agree with that, certainly. But just one thing I'd like to say, just because NM Rothschild is lobbying the government, just as I said earlier on about BP lobbying the government, doesn't mean something's going to happen. And also, just because Vince Cable is a very interesting man who used to be a Labour councillor in Glasgow, mm-hmm. he has still retained some of his old ideas. And even although he says it doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to happen.
Okay, next story then. Get on your soapbox at a new Speaker's Corner in Bristol. Well, it's not exactly a corner. It's at the Arnold Feeney, the Arts Centre. And this is apparently related to climate change. But do you think this is a good idea, that we have sort of a place for members of the public to come in and vent their spleen, if you wish, on climate change?
People do it at Speaker's Corner in Hyde Park in London, and you know, if you go there, you'll hear people doing it. And it used to be a very favourite thing to do in Bristol. People went up to the Downs at Clifton, top of Blackbar Hill there, spouted out up there, and it was very popular. People went there every Sunday to listen. I think probably those were in the days when there were many fewer entertainments on a Sunday afternoon, or at any time really, and there's many more outlets now for people to vent their spleen on, phone-ins to radio stations and all sorts of things, writing in blogs and adding bits to stories that have come, that are going out on the internet. But why not? I hear George Ferguson, who used to be a councillor on Bristol City Council, when just about the time I was on Bristol City Council.
Well, which party? Which party?
Lib Dems.
Okay.
And he was a very interesting man. And he still is. I mean, he's the man behind the tobacco factory and various other developments around about the tobacco factory. And he was president of the Institute of Architects not long ago. So it's always interesting to hear George speak. So if he's going to do it, I'll go and listen.
Are we going to hear you down at the Arnold Feeney, Martin?
I'm not sure. I've got my platform here with you, Tony. The only thing I can think of in relation to this is that I have spoken at Speaker's Corner in London, and many years ago, it was in the run up to the first Gulf War. I was speaking at Speaker's Corner, and I was speaking there on a weekday, and the police approached me and said, "You do realise that the bylaws of the park are that you can only speak on Sunday afternoons between noon and sunset, and only about religious topics." So I said, "You'd better arrest me then." And they went away and had a think about it and decided that wasn't a good idea. But it was an eye-opener, because most people think that they have the right to go to Speaker's Corner and speak. Apparently not. That's what the bylaws of the park actually say. The police actually don't enforce the bylaws, as far as I can see, but they certainly tried to on that occasion.
Okay, Doug, have you ever done much of this sort of public speaking to crowds, like in the old days? You imagine when MPs were at the hustings trying to persuade everyone to vote for them. Do you do this sort of thing?
When I first started, we used to have bigger meetings, but you know, they're not very popular now. The ones that are, where at times it still happens, and I'm very grateful to churches for doing this, is at the times of general elections, they usually organise question time, and they invite all of the candidates for a particular constituency, and they then generally turn out quite a lot of people, and it's mainly talking about development issues and aid issues and that kind of thing. And I think That's probably the area where it happens most still nowadays, but it's died out a bit.
Anyway, so if anyone's interested in speaking or performing at the... apparently, we can do performances as well. Martin, maybe you fancy doing that as well, a little performance rather than just a speech.
The only thing that I would say about it, it's a pity it's limited to climate change. Not that climate change is not interesting, but it's supposed to be just about climate change, and that's a bit restrictive. I'm sure climate change is important, but you'd get more people if it was widened, I think.
And it's taking place at, it looks like 1 p.m. every day, and for a while, for 30 minutes after 1 p.m. So you can either go along and have a listen, or even get up and say something yourself. If you're interested in speaking or performing, please email boxoffice@arnolfini.org.uk. Or call the Arnolfini on 917-2300. Right, next story. 1,000 Bristol postal workers striking today. This is actually from yesterday's Evening Post. 1,000 postal workers across Bristol are on strike today. Now, we've already had Kevin Beezer from the Communication Workers South West Branch in here talking about this a few weeks ago, really a programme dedicated to what's going on in the postal service. Doug, as a local MP, are you behind the strikers?
Well, I've supported the CWU in their campaign to try and avoid the total privatisation of the post office. But I do think it's really rather sad that these two bodies, the management and the workers, can't get together and hammer out some way around this that everybody can agree to.
Isn't that why they're on strike today? Is because they've just not been able to do that.
Well,
my understanding is that there were agreements made between the union and the post office management which have been broken, and that's why the strike's been called.
And that's what I understand too. But
and why are the management breaking those agreements?
Also, it's also got involved with a pay dispute as well, which I'm not sure how the various elements of this pan out.
Martin?
Well, I mean, nobody wants to go on strike. I mean, that's what we've said.
Yeah.
People don't go on strike for fun. It's a very important final human right. Obviously, at the moment, the workforce in the post office are very demoralised. They feel as if the management don't understand their concerns, and the government, it has to be said. And this part privatisation of the post office seems to be descending into farce, in the sense that who is actually going to buy the post office? Some of the companies that they're lining up to buy the post office don't seem to be solvent themselves. So, and at the time when we've seen the collapse of the mainstream financial system, something like a post office savings bank sounds like a jolly useful thing to have. I mean, perhaps we need to be thinking about making the post office part of a local network of mutual savings. We've got to rebuild the financial system from the ground up, and the post office is an obvious place to start.
Okay, next story then. Diane Abbott, in fact, I think this... No, it's not quite the last one. Diane Abbott MP she's a London MP, is doing an advice clinic on how to wipe your DNA from the government database. Apparently, what she's saying is that Tory... And she's doing this alongside the Civil Liberties campaign, Liberty. Tory MP Damien Green recently had his DNA wiped off the database because he is innocent of any crime. This is the MP who was arrested for allegedly leaking material. Diane Abbott believes that what is good for Damien Green is good for everybody else. So, are you the sort of person that might be on the DNA database?
No idea. Could be, I suppose.
And if you are, what are your thoughts about the principle?
I couldn't care less. Personally, it just doesn't worry me. It's just another technique, DNA database, and it's never used as the sole proof in any criminal case. It's sort of corroborative evidence if there's other evidence suggesting that the person was in the area at the time or could have been there, or there's other evidence.
So do you think that police should be keeping files on innocent people?
No,
this is the
point coming around.
Yeah.
If people are really worried about it, then they should have the right to have their DNA wiped if they have been proved innocent. If the police are not proceeding with charges, or if they have been found innocent by a court, then I think they should, if they want to, have it wiped out.
Well, it seems
one thing that needs to be said about it, though, is that the police will produce statistics for you if you ask them, which suggests that people who are on the database, it's often been very useful in solving later crimes. Now, I don't know how to evaluate that. It wouldn't worry me if my DNA was on the database, but I can understand why people would want to have it wiped.
Martin, what about you?
Well, DNA databases and the national ID card and so on, I understand people's concerns about this, and there are obviously reasons to be concerned, and there have to be safeguards if you're going to have these kind of things. But I think people are often missing the point, which is that we all sorts of information is collected about us in a routine fashion. The real problem, as I see it, if we're coming back to the earlier story about Lockerbie, the real problem is if you've got elements within the state apparatus who are abusing the powers that they've been given. And that's not to do with being watched or followed or having your phone tapped. It's things like the commission of criminal acts, like when we're talking about Iran-Contra. The state apparatus there was involved in the commission of criminal acts, and having a database on the population was neither here nor there, because the people who are supposed to be actually looking after the peace of the society are in fact the criminals. That's a real problem. Who guards the guardians?
Okay, okay, so finally, Doug, I've just been going through a website called theyworkforyou.com, mm-hmm. And looking at some of the, what they say anyway, that you've voted for and against. You're very strongly against the replacing of the Trident submarine.
I've always voted against Trident since I've been
Can I just make a point to you? You did this with Kerry last week. You're saying you were strongly against this and strongly against that, and she said, of course, what that means is she voted. You voted one way or the other.
I've been a member of CND for many, many years, and I have no intention of no longer being a member.
One of the things that you can help explain here, though, is that you voted very moderately. Now, I don't quite know what that means. I'm just quoting them. Voting moderately against the Iraq war, but then you voted strongly, very strongly against an investigation. How can you explain that?
Moderately for the Iraq war, it probably means I missed a vote. I wasn't around for some reason or other.
So, yeah,
certainly voted against the Iraq war and an investigation.
So why should you vote against the investigation?
Because the investigation had been promised when our troops came out of Iraq, and it seemed to me that was perfectly a reasonable thing to do. I mean, I didn't vote against the principle of an investigation. This was something put down by the opposition calling for an investigation to be started immediately. And it would have been a confidence vote in the government as well.
Okay, and I do recommend this site. I must admit, the quotes aren't necessarily brilliant, are they? Very strongly against and strongly for. But there's some really interesting stuff about the way various MPs have voted on theyworkforyou.com. Yeah. Anyway, it's coming up, the Sky News at 6 very soon, so that's all for this week. Do please join us at 5 on Friday Drive Time every week here on BCFM 93.2, where we review the week's news and discuss some of the big stories in Bristol, Britain and around the world. If you want something discussed here, have questions about this evening's programme, or would like to suggest a topic or guest for a future show, please email me at tony@bcfm.org.uk. Thanks very much to this week's guest, Doug Naismith, Labour MP for Bristol North West, and our resident old Labour pundit and Oxford economist, Martin Summers. Your views on Bristol's local and regional media were courtesy of our reporter, Marina Morris. Next week, editor of the Bristol's bilingual Somali Voice paper, Kaisi Maximus, will be with us, and you can listen to previous week's shows and find out what's going on next week by going to bcfm.org.uk, where you can find my page. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend.
Everybody in Bristol, a voice.